ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Why did Matthew Flinders write such saucy letters to his best friend, George Bass?
Who really chopped off Chopper's ears?
And why did they name a swimming pool after an Australian Prime Minister who drowned?
These are the kind of historical questions we'll be asking on The Dead Can't Sue.
So join me, Alicia Simmons.
And me, Lee Boucher.
Find it by searching for The Dead Can't Sue on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
On The Science Show this week, we trace the history of volcanic eruptions through traditional knowledge.
And the shudders of Antarctic glaciers using a gigantic ultrasound.
Find out how to bake gluten-free cakes that actually taste good.
And hear students read prize-winning essays about what matters to them. Hello, I'm Robin Williams.
And I'm Belinda Smith. I grew up in Western Victoria and, as a result, I had many school trips across the South Australian border to the Mount Gambier or Berrin region, which are the traditional lands of the Bowendig people. And, Robin, it's quite a dramatic landscape. If you've not been there, I'll just describe it. There's loads of dormant volcanoes in this region and it's been a few thousand years since any of these volcanoes last erupted. But Western science hasn't been able to nail down exactly the order in which a couple of them last blew their top. But Bowendig oral histories have now helped solve this mystery. Auntie Michelle Jacqueline Furr, a proud Bowendig woman, told me the creation story of a giant called Cratebull.
He lived on Bowendig land with his wife and two children thousands of years ago. He wanted to find a place that was safe, away from the evil spirit, War or Tentatanoa. He decided that he would move over to Belita, which is Mount Muirhead near Millicent in South Australia. When he got there, he saw Belita and he thought, this is a really good place to make an oven. He got his digging stick out, he dug into the side of Belita and he made a beautiful oven. The family lived there for many, many years. The wife would go digging for yams. The boys and Cratebull would go hunting for animals, koora, kangaroo, cabbie, the emu. It was a great place to live. Every night, Cratebull would stand up with his spear as his family settled down to sleep. He would bang the spear into the ground and he would say, this is safe to sleep. One night, he looked up and across the skies came a bird, the bullen bird. It shrieked and made a terrible sound. Cratebull jumped to his feet. He got his wife and his children. He said, come on, we've got to go. The evil spirit is showing us here that the bullen bird has found us and it could lead the spirits to find us as well. They took off running and made the journey over to Perrine, which is Mount Shank on the way to Port Macdonald or Narunga. They got to Perrine. It was a great little place. It was near the sea. They could see Narunga. It was all the beautiful kuya. All the eels were coming around there. There was lots of cabbies. There were kangaroos. Food was plentiful. Lots of kurung snake. A really, really great place to live. Cratebull, every night again, stood with his spear. It's safe to sleep. One night, in came the bullen bird. It screeched and roared. Cratebull jumped to his feet. He got his wife up and his two boys, and he said, we're being warned again. The evil spirit could find us. So they started on a journey which took them up to the area around Verran, which were huge mountains. The first mountain that he dug out was Warwar, and this became the Blue Lake. He got his digging stick. He dug it out. It was a great oven. They stayed there for quite a while, but all the waters came up from the bottom and put out his fire. Cratebull was furious. He stamped his feet, he threw rocks, he screamed and yelled. He said to his family, we're going to move over the mountain and we're going to go to Yattenloo.
This creation story, passed down over thousands of years, piqued the interest of Dr. Heather Handley, a volcanologist and senior curator of geosciences at the Museums Victoria Research Institute. Because while Western science has been able to determine roughly when the volcanoes of the region erupted, these calculations can't tell us everything.
The youngest volcanism that's occurred across mainland Australia is at Mount Gambier and Mount Shank, so at Berrin and Perrine. And there, the activity occurred around 5,000 years ago. And there's been a lot of dates produced, but because of the errors on these scientific dates, we can't really be certain which volcano is the youngest, actually. So everybody says Mount Gember is the youngest, but is not scientifically conclusive yet.
One technique scientists have used to find out when these volcanoes last erupted is called paleomagnetic dating.
If you think about iron-rich minerals that are in the volcanic rocks, they act as tiny natural compasses, and so they align with Earth's magnetic field at the time of the eruption. So when it cools and solidifies, these little magnetic crystals, they become locked and forever set in stone in the direction of the Earth's magnetic field. And so from dating of their directions, they could tell that the two eruptions are about 300 years apart of each other, but that method also couldn't tell which one came first.
The Bowen-Dick creation story of Crateville, on the other hand, can.
So this story actually gives an indication that Mount Muirhead, we know for sure, is much older than the other two volcanoes. But this oral tradition indicates that Mount Schenck is older than Mount Gambier. And this is something that the scientific study of the volcanoes has not yet conclusively established.
So these volcanoes are dormant, but roughly how long ago did they last erupt?
So Mount Muirhead actually doesn't have a very good age constraint on it, but we can tell because it has quite an eroded form now, and it has kind of sediments on top of it. We know it's a lot older than the other two. Mount Gambier and Mount Schenck both are thought to have erupted about 5,000 years ago.
Now, that particular story, Crateville, it's a creation story. And that one there is showing just how long Bowen-Dick people have been in this land. Belita, Mount Muirhead, that eruption, that screaming and yelling of Crateville was all the eruptions. And we're depicting that. So that was over 20,000 years ago, and that's in our stories. Bowen-Dick people were there and witnessed those eruptions.
Most of Australia, you don't really think of it as particularly volcanic, but there are a couple of recently volcanic areas. So the area in southeast Australia, which is called the New Volcanic Province, and then there's another region in northern Queensland. So why were those two regions volcanic and not other places in Australia?
So since the demise of the dinosaurs around 66 million years ago, we've actually had a huge amount of volcanism all down the east coast of Australia. And like you say, the most recent areas are two areas, one in the northeast in northeast Queensland and an area that stretches from Melbourne all across to Mount Gambier, the new volcanic province. And here, what we think is happening is it's a mixture of the plates moving northwards, the Australian plates moving northwards quite fast, and that causes this kind of like shear underneath, this kind of friction.
But there's also something going on under the surface at these particular spots.
The structure of the Earth is made of the crust, and then we have the mantle and the upper mantle part. So the crust and the upper mantle in Australia has steps, so that's called the lithosphere. And where we get these steps, then we can get upwelling of the mantle. So where that happens, the pressure is less and it can start to melt. So what we've got is a combination of this fast movement and this shearing at the bottom, but we also have these areas where we've got steps in this lithosphere, this thickness. So it seems to be a fairly localized region across that newer volcanic province and in northeast Australia where we see these kind of melting characteristics. But there's actually a lot of debate at the moment, even some of the older volcanoes. How do we get magma to form, this molten rock to form, in an area like Australia where we are so far away from these tectonic plate boundaries where we normally see volcanic activity and tectonic activity like earthquakes, such as around the Ring of Fire. So it's still actually an area of ongoing research and there's still much to discover.
What do oral histories of the volcanic area up north say about eruptions?
So in northeastern Australia, there's an example from Lake Eacham, which is a mar volcano in the Atherton volcanic province. And there's a story and oral tradition in the Yidningi language and also the Djerbal language. So it was related to the actions of these newly initiated men who broke important taboos and angered the rainbow serpent, which then caused this event to take place. And the story recalls how one of the elders told the newly initiated men to sit still while he went off to go and gather food, and they apparently didn't. So what he saw while he was away collecting the food was the sky starting to turn yellow and a big cloud in the sky and a wind starting to blow. And then the animals at that point were running away, in part blown by the wind. And the story goes on, and he started to return. He knew there was some sort of problem. He knew the newly initiated men had maybe done something wrong. So he starts to return to the camp, and then he sees the cloud get higher and it turns more yellow. And then as he tries to cut and hit the ground, making cuts to try and stop this wind and this rain, but then unfortunately it says that everybody who was camped at the place was lost, so was kind of swallowed by the ground. So the type of volcanism that happens in a Amalfi-forming volcano, these are not positive volcanic cones on the landscape, what we might imagine a volcano to be. It's formed by magma or molten rock coming towards the surface, and it might interact with some groundwater or aquifer, causing these big explosive eruptions. It's a little bit like if you had hot cooking oil mixing with cold water, and it creates these big explosive eruptions, and it produces a lot of ash. And so the style of eruption that we see at Lake Eachem also marries well with the story that comes through in the oral tradition. But what's really important from this one is this warning time frame. The story mentions that people were lost at the camp. It mentions that the animals ran away during the eruption, not before, and were in part blown by the wind. So this to me really indicates that when this eruption occurred, it produces these base surges, which are a bit like, you know, these pyroclastic flows that you see on movies like Dante's Peak. But it does them on a more local level, but it produces quite strong, fast-moving clouds of ash and gas. So these are quite hazardous eruptions when they happen. And it shows that they were all caught off guard. They didn't have much warning of this. So that's really important from understanding if there was to be future activity in any of these active areas. We see Amalfi-forming volcanoes both in northeast Queensland and a lot of them also in the Newer Volcanic Province in the southeast of the country. It shows from the stories that they may happen with little warning. And what I'm also doing within my own scientific research is trying to understand these warning timeframes by trying to work out how fast molten rock moves from deep underground to the surface. And we're also getting very short warning timeframes from that, so fast movement of magma from deep underground to the surface. So it also indicates from, you know, a preparedness perspective is that we need to be prepared for very little warning of future activity in potentially these still active areas.
Now, your study didn't just look at Australia, it looked at the wider Pacific. And of course, the Pacific is much more volcanic than the Australian continent. So how did you find traditional knowledge already being used in early warning systems for volcanic activity in the Pacific?
So like modern approaches to risk planning, traditional societies also develop responses grounded in their perceived understanding of its causes. And so identifying precursors to eruptions remains a key element of Indigenous risk management. And so an example of this in the Pacific is from Savo Island in the Solomon Islands. There, Savo is an emergent part of an ocean floor stratovolcano with a history of regular eruptions. And most of the inhabitants on the island live in coastal villages. And so they look at these cycles of how the coastal land is prograding, so from past eruptions, so growing outwards, and then receding from when it gets eroded. And they recognize these kind of periodicity to the eruptions and the timeframes of eruptions that they've noticed, these patterns over long time periods. And so through their oral traditions and knowledge, they've been looking at coastline changes so that they see that when the coastline approaches that of what they call old Savo, which means a more eroded form of the landscape, they recognize that there might be an eruption soon or imminent. And so this kind of precursor recognition of landscape changes is one form of risk management through traditional knowledge.
To maintain Bowendick traditional knowledge and culture, Auntie Michelle has worked to revive the Bowendick language, Bugenditch, and teach oral histories to the next generation, like how the Bowendick people got fire.
And that's a story of a person that was banished from a Bowendick tribe. He was over right over near the mountains, over near the Grampians, and then he came back and he had fire from there, but he came back with different stories. He had different rocks. He had different things that we traded and we made our axes from. So it was granite from over at the Grampians. So when they're dug up at Belita, there was actually some dug up there, which is one of Craikbull's first ovens. And there they brought, turned up all the stone granite axes that the Bowen Dick had made using the granite from over near the Grampians. And I can't tell anyone else's story, but I know with the eel trapping around the Gunditjmara mob, they've got evidence too of different volcanic things that happened, which again fit in with all the things that we've got people like Heather telling their stories. And you can say, yes, just a minute, this happened as well.
You might be wondering what happened to Crate Bull and his family. Well, where we'd left off, he'd dug an oven at Berrin, Mount Gambier, but it filled with water, which became Warwar or Blue Lake. Understandably annoyed, he took his family to another spot called Yatinlu.
And Yatinlu was the next area that he dug his small oven in. Good little oven, worked well, but again, up came the waters, put out the fire. He was furious. He said, I'm going over the hill again and I'm going to dig the next one, which was Ketlamalpi. Now, Ketlamalpi means sacred tree. So we know for the Bowen Dick that Ketlamalpi was a sacred area to the Bowen Dick people. He dug that one out, great little place again. The family lived there for some time, but up came the waters. He was furious. Again, the rock throwing, and he screamed and yelled. The family ran away. It was frightening. He said, I'm doing one more oven. He moved over again to the next area, Krowara Wadi. Now, that means Road of the Emus. So we know there were lots and lots of cabby or emus around that area. So good little oven again. The family lived there very successfully, but up came the waters, put out the fire. Ha! Oh, screamed and yelled. He said, that's it. We're going right up, and it's where the tower is today in Berrin, Mount Gambier, right up on the top. And just under that, there's a small cave. And Crate Bull said, we're going to take the family up and we're going to live there in that area until our time comes to leave this earth. So he took the family up there, dug the cave out a little bit more, and they lived there until their time came. When their time came, he banged the spear again on the ground. It elongated, huge. Crate Bull sat on the back, the two boys in the middle, his wife on the front, and they went up, up, up into the skies. And they're there to this day. Years ago, Bowen Dick people would look up when they were travelling and they could say, there's Crate Bull and the family, this is where camp is, or this is where we're going. And we still do that today.
Auntie Michelle Jacqueline Furr. We also heard from Dr. Heather Handley, a volcanologist and senior curator of geosciences at the Museums Victoria Research Institute. And she said that further research may explore how traditional knowledge can be ethically embedded into more volcanic early warning systems.
Yes, indeed. But what about earthquakes? The sheer scale and impacts of the earthquake that hit in Venezuela are staggering. Surely by now in 2026, we should be more aware of the coming of quakes. But there still is a shocking surprise. No, it doesn't happen. Another puzzle, as I found out in Caltech, a world-leading researcher in the field often forsakes the promise of Los Angeles sitting right there on a convenient fault line to go all the way south instead to investigate shaking glaciers in Antarctica. Here's John Wyndan at Caltech at the Seismological Laboratory.
Professor, is it true that you have a book at home, I presume, written by Professor Bruce Bolt, once of Berkeley, and an Australian seismologist?
Yes. So Bruce is a famous seismologist at Berkeley, very influential one.
And he was the first person I ever interviewed in the United States. Yeah. And that was way back in 1975. But you are also, would you call yourself a geophysicist in general or a seismologist?
I would mostly call myself a seismologist.
Is seismo a word, is it from Greece, meaning shaking or something?
Yeah, so that's why sometimes when we say seismology, we don't always equivalent it with earthquake science. Seismology is really the discipline that studies how things vibrate, mostly in the earth science context. But when you are studying vibration, it could be caused by earthquake, and that's one of the major topics, but it can be caused by many other things. And also the vibration, you study them, you not only get to learn about earthquake source, like how they happen, what kind of damage they produce, you also learn about their medium, the earth that they are propagating through, which is almost half of seismology as well.
And those vibrations tell you about the shape of the earth, its movement in general and how it's put together. But what I don't quite understand, as you're in Los Angeles, where there's so much vibration going on and activity, you go to Antarctica, a long way away. Why's that?
Yes, I got to go to Antarctica twice. A couple of years ago, I went to the South Pole Station. So in December 2025, we went to Antarctica again, doing seismic experiment.
Drilling down through the ice?
No, so that's actually a really beautiful thing about applying seismology to glaciers. So glaciers sometimes are hundreds of meters or kilometers thick. And many of the processes that's interesting is at the base of the glacier, because that's where ice is sliding over the bed. And how fast they slide really controls how much ice you lose to the ocean. It's only the ice you lose to the ocean cause the sea level rise. So we always want to sample or understand what's happening at the base, but drilling is very expensive. It's probably still the best way to do this kind of science. Very expensive to drill, and also you get to sample only one location when you're doing that. So if you imagine the glacier base is like any river instead of flowing water but flowing ice, if you sample only one point, you might not get the full picture of it. That's where seismology comes in really neatly. It's using the seismic waves to bounce off from the base and understand what's happening there. This is the same thing as when you go in the hospital and you do ultrasound imaging of your body to figure out if there's any anomaly there. So we basically set up a big ultrasound sensing device on the surface of ice, sending wave to the base, listen to the echoes, and try to figure out at the base what's happening, whether there is something that can tell us how ice is going to flow faster or slower in the wake of climate change.
And the result recently, is it melting faster these days?
What we are interested in this particular case was how the ocean water will come underneath the ice shelves and melt it from below, because that's something very hard to measure. You can, for the surface melt, you can use a satellite, and if you see a blue pond of water on the surface, like they observe a lot of them in Greenland, then it's obvious, right? Every year you can go back to check that. But at the base of ice, that's under a mile of ice, how do you know what's happening there?
So there just are, imagine a mile, a kilometer, 1.5 kilometers of just sheer ice lying there.
Yeah, exactly. We also know there are water that's flushing in and out at the base. How do you know if the ocean is definitely warming? You can see that in the open ocean from satellite. Those warm water now going underneath the ice so that you're melting from below very efficiently. Not only you're melting them from below, if you melt the ice there, it actually encourages the ice to flow faster into it, because you're kind of removing the resistance from below, so the whole ice will move into the ocean faster. This has been observed, but we don't really understand how exactly that happens. So there are models about how the ice will be pumping water into what we call the cavity, basically there's space underneath the ice due to a tidal motion, and that would enhance the melting by many, many times. And our project last year was trying to understand that process.
And the process with that water going in and out, loosening the gigantic amounts of ice, producing icebergs, going out to the water, the ocean water, and melting, and as you say, raising the level. It's a huge work. Now, what you're doing back here on land, you have fiber optics going down instead of ultrasound measuring. You've got these different sensors going deep and deeper and deeper.
Yes, you are right. So fiber optics is a very powerful tool. So these days, almost all our communication are going fiber optic cables, both on land and in the ocean. So what we are doing is really just converting the ones that's already deployed for the telecom into sensors. So far, we don't have the resource to drill deep holes, even on land, to put fibers in them. That's one of my dreams. I hope one day I can drip many holes in Southern California. Each one of them may be a mile or two deep, and we can put fibers in them. We can get closer to the source of earthquakes. But that's still enormously expensive, just like drilling. Actually, drilling on ice is cheaper compared to what you would drill on rocks. Because on ice, you can do a hot water drilling, and that can penetrate through ice, a thick ice, within a few hours. You drill a deep hole on land through rocks, it's going to take many months to do that, right? So it's more expensive. But even just using the fiber that has been deployed over the last tens of years, just along the street, along the highway, connecting different cities, we can turn them into millions of seismic sensors, where currently we only have hundreds of them. So we are really not going deeper, but we are extending the surface coverage of the sensors. So hopefully we can capture smaller earthquakes. Also, when bigger earthquakes happen, we have more sensors. We can see exactly how the rupture fault, and maybe that one day can tell us how to anticipate the influence of these earthquakes.
I was going to come towards anticipation later, but it's what most people ask. But when you mention cities, when you've got an area like Greater Los Angeles, these gigantic cities, how can you cover in any kind of complete way metropolises like that?
Actually, we already have a lot of stations in the urban areas. It's interesting that, like, seismic sensors, you dig a hole on the ground, you're burying them in, but you still need a lot of infrastructure to support it. You need power. You need, you know, data transfer. These days, many of those are cell phone. In the old days, it's all radio, but now it's all internet. And in urban areas, actually, you've got a lot of these infrastructures, and there are many people willing to help in this process. Many big utility companies are willing to host our sensors, even in every urban areas. So actually, even in Southern California, I actually have much denser stations than if you are outside in the desert. But even that is may not be enough, because in the cities, we still have a sensor spacing about, I would say, on the order of 5 to 10 miles. That's the space we have. But any earthquake we observe, either here or around the world, we always see the shaking after earthquake change much more quickly than that. Sometimes two houses, almost identical, separated only by 2-3 blocks, have completely different fates. Right? One collapse, one still standing. And sometimes it's not just the engineering. Sometimes it's about the subsurface structures. Maybe one of them was sitting on top of the sediment coming from ancient rivers. So it's much more loose sediment. So when earthquake shaking happens, they amplify it like a jello, you know, shaking more widely in one location than any other locations. And those can change on the order of tens of meters or hundreds of meters. And then when you have sensors every several kilometers, several miles, you really don't capture those. That's also one thing I'm hoping to change here, especially in urban areas, because the need of high-speed internet, now there are really fiber optic cables everywhere. About half of them are actually on the poles, so they are not very helpful. But the other half is actually underground, because people also want to protect them. They don't want to have a windstorm and the trees falling and suddenly you lose power and the internet. So some of these cables are actually already underground, and these are perfect for us to convert into sensors. Then we can start to resolve this kind of variations in the subsurface. Hopefully one day we can have a map that we can tell people, you know, you should spend some money to retrofit your house, because this house is going to experience a stronger shaking in the next earthquake.
Professor John Wyndan of the Caltech Seismological Laboratory.
And this is the Science Show on ABC Radio National. Now, the past couple of weeks, I've been moonlighting as co-host on the Health Report, Robin. And last week, I reported a story about celiac disease. Now, did you know there are scientists out there who are developing celiac-safe wheat? Anyway, until that's a widely available ingredient, I've been playing with gluten-free baking. I've had some hits and misses, mostly misses, to be honest. But luckily for me, Katarina Shamil put her PhD in chemistry to work in her quest for perfect gluten-free baking. And for her, it happened out of necessity.
So I had to eliminate gluten and dairy for a while because of some health issues, which later on turned out to be not at all related to gluten and dairy. But during that period when I didn't eat either, I felt kind of lost because I always baked a lot. And then all of a sudden, I was basically forced to eliminate two of the major components that basically make regular baking work. So as probably most people experience when they embark on a gluten and or dairy free journey, my results weren't great. So, you know, rock hard cookies, or on the other hand, cookies that crumbled away into nothing, like rubbery cakes. It was basically a disaster. But then I thought to myself, you studied chemistry, you should be able to set up experiments and figure out what's going on. And then over time, with many, many experiments, both failed and successful, I eventually got the hang of it.
Can you walk me through what these experiments would entail?
Basically, a lot of Excel spreadsheets, keeping track of ingredient ratios, and basically just getting a hang of what each ingredient does. And especially on the gluten-free front, getting to understand what roles gluten plays in regular baking, and then what ingredients you can use in gluten-free baking to mimic those effects, but also learning how gluten-free flours behave differently from regular wheat flour and how you can mitigate those differences to achieve basically a result that's as close to possible to the regular version.
I imagine it's like refining like a lab protocol. You just do different iterations and keep track of what you change and the result.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, that's where the Excel spreadsheets come in. Just getting to know, okay, that's the optimal ratio between the gluten-free flour and butter in a shortbread cookie recipe so that you get the delicate texture, but they also keep their shape. So yeah, definitely lots of, you know, keeping track of variables, trends, and stuff like that.
Gosh, that just sounds like so much work, but I do love myself a spreadsheet. Okay, so gluten, fundamental part of a lot of baking. Well, what is gluten?
So gluten is actually a composite of two proteins, gliadins and glutenins, that are found in cereal grains, primarily wheat, but also barley and rye. And basically, when gliadin and glutenin come into contact with water, they bind together to form gluten. And as far as its role in regular baking, gluten basically provides some extensibility and flexibility to bakes. It basically is like a glue that holds them together, but it's especially important in bread. It gives the dough that elasticity and flexibility so you can shape it, and it also gives the typical chewy texture to a loaf of bread.
So that's why a lot of gluten-free breads, even though it's fresh bread and untoasted, you break it in half and it just snaps in half like a piece of wood, basically.
Yeah, basically. Or it crumbles away into nothing. The main way in which you can mimic the effects of gluten is through alternative binders, and in gluten-free baking, that's primarily xanthan gum and psyllium husk. So me personally, I mainly use xanthan gum for non-bread bakes, so things like cookies, cakes, pastry, muffins, things like that, where you do want some elasticity, but it's more to keep hold the bakes together to prevent them from being too crumbly, but you don't exactly want a chewy texture in your cake or cookie. And then psyllium husk is an absolutely magical ingredient when it comes to gluten-free bread, because it gives you a dough that you can actually knead and shape and even make more complex shapes, like, you know, cinnamon rolls or babka or challah or things like that, where you're not just restricted to basically pouring a batter into a loaf tin, which you would be forced to do without the psyllium husk. And it also gives the gluten-free bread dough enough elasticity so it can expand during proofing. And then it also gives the baked bread that typical chewy texture you'd expect from, you know, a proper loaf of bread rather than it being cake-like.
What is xanthan gum?
So xanthan gum is basically a polysaccharide that's produced by a bacterium that feeds on corn, very simplistically. In practical applications, it's basically a white powder. It looks very similar to things like baking powder or baking soda that you basically add to your dry ingredients and it does its job. One thing I will say, important for people who are not familiar with xanthogen. If you spill it over any surface, wipe it away with a dry cloth. Don't go at it with water because it creates a slippery mess that's impossible to clean up.
See, I wish you told me that about 2 months ago because my little packet of xanthan gum has a tiny little hole in the bottom and I keep forgetting. And so bits of it drop out. And yeah. So I just go and wipe it down. But then it's like mucus. It's gross. And yeah, you can't get rid of it.
I mean, to be fair, that mucus property is what we make use of in gluten-free baking because it creates a sticky elastic gel. But in terms of cleanup, it's a nightmare.
Good to know. Use a dry cloth. I will remember that next time. So, of course, we can't just take out the plain flour and throw in some xanthan gum or psyllium husk. There has to be some bulk there as well. And I noticed that you tend to use a combination of flours. You don't just substitute wheat flour for, say, rice flour plus some psyllium husk. There's more to it than that. So what is the basis for blending different types of gluten-free flours to get something that's more approximate to wheat flour?
So I like to categorize gluten-free flours into three groups. One are starchy flours, which is self-explanatory. It's things like cornstarch, potato starch, arrowroot starch, and those really are there to make the bakes lighter. They don't contribute any structure, they don't contribute any flavor, but they're essential if you want to achieve a light arrow result. And then there are protein flours, which are also subdivided into light protein flours and heavy protein flours, but overall, protein flours are the structure and flavor providing ingredients in a gluten-free flour blend. So there are things like millet flour, sorghum flour, buckwheat flour, and loads of others. And depending on what kind of texture you want to achieve and what you're baking, that ratio of the starchy flours to protein flours is really essential. You can't really achieve the best possible result by just using one of the groups. You always need a certain ratio of both.
And does that ratio change depending on the type of thing you're making, say bread versus cookies?
Yes, absolutely. So most commercial gluten-free flour blends that you might buy in a shop, they're mostly formulated to work really well with cakes, pastries, cookies, and things like that. And they're typically a bit higher in starches. You do want that light texture, whereas with bread, if the starch content is too high, you can get quite a gummy and unpleasantly sticky texture. So there, I do prefer to basically mix up my own specific blend for that specific bread recipe. So I wouldn't recommend using a one-to-one gluten-free flour in bread, because there you do want a higher percentage of protein flours to get that proper structure.
And gluten-free flours are different to wheat flours because they absorb water differently. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Something about hydration? Yeah.
Yes. On average, gluten-free flours absorb more moisture than wheat flour. What that means in practice is if you were to take a regular cake recipe that uses wheat flour and just one-to-one substitute the same amount of gluten-free flour into that recipe, your result would probably be too dry. So what I tend to do is use about 10% less of gluten-free flour in a cake recipe compared to a regular recipe, just to get that balance right, and that produces a lovely moist result.
I've noticed that the gluten-free breads and things that I've been making do tend to be more on the, I won't say sloppier side, but the wetter side. So bread dough won't be a nice big solid lump. You can knead it, but it can get quite sticky. So you have to make sure that you flour the surface without overflouring the bread dough itself and making it stodgy in the process.
Yes, absolutely. So I think what can surprise people when they first start making gluten-free bread is that with regular bread, even if your dough is sticky, over time as you're kneading it, you're creating enough tension in the dough, enough surface tension as you're shaping it, that the eventual end result can become easier to handle. And even if you lightly touch it on its surface, because of the gluten network, it won't be tacky. With gluten-free bread, as you're handling the dough, and if you really get stuck into it, it will always be sticky. So the trick is to basically create a thin layer of flour on the surface of your dough without, as you said, incorporating too much flour into the actual dough, but just enough that surface layer is just enough so you can handle it easily. It's just about learning how to properly handle the gluten-free dough, because it is a completely different beast compared to the one made with regular wheat flour.
Is there a recipe that you really want to crack but you just
can't for some reason, or you feel like you're right on the edge, but you haven't quite got there yet?
Gluten-free croissants.
Oh, the holy grail.
Exactly. I've been working on this recipe for years at this point, and I will say that I am so close to getting an actual gluten-free croissant with an actual honeycomb structure inside, which will be like probably my proudest achievement, and I won't be able to beat it ever. So yes, I'm currently working on it, refining it, fingers crossed, because I've been wanting to master gluten-free croissants for, as I said, ages.
What makes a croissant so hard to make gluten-free?
I think it's because you need to balance so many things at the same time. So probably any baker will tell you that even regular croissants are tricky. With gluten-free, you have so many other issues to contend with. So for instance, when you make regular croissants, you obviously need to have all that multitude of very thin butter dough layers. And the gluten makes it very easy because it's elastic. So basically when you're rolling it out, you're stretching the dough very thinly and it won't crack or tear. With gluten-free baking, you don't have that elasticity. So you need to get just the right content of both psyllium husk and xanthan gum to get just the right texture so the dough stretches. But at the same time, you don't want it too elastic because you don't want the end result to be too chewy. Mm. And then you also have the issue that because gluten-free flours can't tolerate fat quite as well as regular flour, you get more fat leakage in the oven. So it's all those things where you need to get just the right balance of basically everything to get a good result. So for a regular loaf of bread, you might be keeping track of, I don't know, 3 variables. With gluten-free croissants, it feels like you're keeping track of 10 or 15. So it's just many things to think about at once. And once I get the recipe perfect, it'll be easy to follow. I personally don't find the process of making croissants super difficult. It's just probably because I've made it like 10,000 times at this point. It's just that getting the recipe right and just the right ratios, it's been a process.
I can imagine the spreadsheet for that one.
Several spreadsheets.
Wow.
Yeah.
Dr. Katharina Shamil, cookbook author and food blogger. You can find her online, search for The Loopy Whisk. Robin, have you had much luck with gluten-free baking?
No, I tend to go for free-for-all, but I did once ask, being supercilious, in a grog shop, have you got any gluten-free gin? And they said yes and produced a bottle accordingly.
Oh,
I was
fantastic.
Astounded.
Now, we finish today with a simple but important question. What matters to young Australians?
Yes. Regular listeners of The Science Show will know the Whitlam Institute at Western Sydney University has been asking students what matters to them for more than 20 years. And the Institute has had more than 50,000 entries since its essay competition started in 2004. One theme that appears time and again is climate change and our changing environment. But don't take it from me. Here are past winners Maisie, Joseph and Ruby. And they spoke to Amy Briggs.
Ruby was born and raised in Sydney, but to her, what has and always will matter is her country.
Here, it melts away and I can breathe, feel the air freshen my lungs. The breathtaking landscape is vast and spectacular. The beauty of the trees and the ranges that they travel all over, drawing my eye as I take in the scale and luxurious colours of this place of my ancestors. My eyes see the colours around me, from ochre yellows to obsidian blacks and so many colours on the spectrum in between. I hear the land and air move around me as well as the animals' movements and calls, and in this moment I know I feel the symbiosis of country. I know that the trees and the plants rely on this environment around them to flourish, and all animals that live on land breathe the oxygen provided by the trees and plants and are nourished by the food they also provide, only to one day return to the earth and nourish it in return. As I am immersed in everything around me, I feel the responsibility of protecting it. I know it is vulnerable to destruction because I have seen it and can feel the urgency in my being to protect this place, the life that it sustains and the stories it holds. There are those that look at country and do not see songlines, history, community and symbiosis, but see profit and opportunity, but I will fight to protect it alongside my people and allies, I am a Gamilaroyina, and to me, this is what matters always.
You wrote that essay how long ago now?
3 years now.
Yeah, and how does it feel reading it back again?
It makes me feel really connected to who I was when I wrote it, and it also makes me feel proud of the feelings that haven't changed. I still recognize the same sense of peace and belonging when I'm on country at the same time, but it feels a bit heavier now, understanding more about how fragile the connection is and the responsibility that comes with it. I grew up in South Sydney. I was born there, raised there, and it was only a year after writing this piece I actually moved to Tamworth, which is pretty much the centre of Gamilaroi land.
Because you describe the country around you so well in your essay, have you noticed any changes in the land since?
Living on country, not only do I see more of my land and how it's used, but also how it's been overlooked, and just watching the impact of development and decisions that don't prioritize land at all, watching it slowly get taken over more and more, kind of makes you feel a bit powerless.
Do you feel a greater sense of needing to protect the environment because of your connection to country?
My connection to country helps me understand my responsibility, as well as the responsibility of my mob and other mobs, to look after and advocate for the land, because if we don't understand the land, then who else is going to protect it? I think if people could learn to view the land in the way that I do and my family does, I think it would be really beneficial to put into perspective just the sheer importance and how much we rely on land.
What are you hopeful for?
Well, I'm hopeful that we can find better ways to do things that we're doing right now. There's so much detrimental infrastructure that may be considered essential for our population, but there can also be other ways to figure out how to make it less impactful on country, how to help not exactly revert it back to the way it was, because we've passed the point of no return when it comes to reverting it to the way it was. It's just a matter of conserving what's still here.
Conservation matters to Ruby, and also to other young people, including another former winner, Joseph, who cares about conserving our creepy crawlies.
What matters to me is how many insects are dying and becoming extinct. Over the last 40 years, there has been a dramatic decrease in insects all over the world. When I was younger, I used to see many more types of interesting insects carrying on with their daily business, and I want this to continue for future generations. Imagine your favourite bug or butterfly disappearing in your lifetime because of what humans have done. If insects were to vanish, then a chain reaction would occur in the world's food chain. Animals such as lizards, that mainly eat insects, would also become extinct. Many birds would then be next, and eventually, the road to extinction lead to us, humans. We need to think about our actions now. You might ask, how are we killing insects? One of the major causes is deforestation. Globally, we need to care for insects by not contributing to further deforestation and using organic methods of farming, meaning no pesticides used. You can help by using only recycled paper products and even planting a tree or shrub. We have to care for insects because they care for us.
You wrote that essay a long time ago, but do you remember what the inspiration was for it?
The inspiration came when I was at school, and I thought about all the times that I spent at home in the garden, outside school. There were bugs everywhere, and I'd seen that bug populations were becoming a lot more of a monoculture. There were only, I think, bull ants were the only ants that were remaining by the time I was in year six, and just moths. That was it. That was all that was there, which was quite shocking to see.
You finished school now, and that was, again, written over 7 years ago. What's changed for you now? Are you still out in the bush? Are you still connected to nature?
I have recently become more connected with nature again as I've entered uni. I'm currently studying a Bachelor of Science majoring in biotechnology. As of the last year or two, I've also been involved in creating cannabis in Greater Sydney project from Greater Sydney Landcare, which is reforestation. We would go out onto the field, plant trees, a lot of eucalyptus, a lot of native flora.
Yeah. It's really interesting that you've written this essay 7 years later, still out and about, still connected to biology. I guess, would you say that this topic matters to you now, or what does matter to you now?
I would say the number one thing is the reforestation projects, and I'd say a close second is the amount of pollution that is in water. A lot of water supplies, especially in Australia, are polluted, and it's causing a significant amount of damage in creeks, waterways. You'll see plastic floating everywhere.
Yeah. And I guess, are you hopeful that these problems will be fixed at some point?
I mean, I'm quite hopeful that these problems will be fixed. It just needs more awareness. A lot more people need to realise that even if they aren't pouring a lot of money into conservation efforts, they themselves can reduce their own impact and stop fueling the problem. A lot of people are not very conscious when they go to the shops. For example, you can buy fruits and vegetables that aren't individually packaged or in box. I mean, you could buy them in cardboard boxes. It's a lot better. Mm. Everyone could work together to fix and solve the problems that we've created.
Whilst thinking about the impact of plastic on bugs and water, other students have also turned to the impacts of water, of flooding events on communities. Like many across the country, Maisie was concerned about what she saw on the news during the 2022 Lismore flooding event, enough that she decided to write about it.
I lay awake in my bed, staring blankly at the dark ceiling. The house was devoid of sound apart from the steady breathing of my sister in the room next to mine, and the melodic thrum of rain hitting the roof. Drops of water that glistened like rhinestones clung to waxy leaves outside my window. I drew a breath and closed my eyes. The rhythmic sound of rain hitting the ground created a lulling white noise, and I soon drifted to sleep. The next day, the rain had slowed to a soft drizzle. The deluge had caused a flash flood at the bottom of my street, and the sludgy water was waist deep. Several cars had been bogged down, and the local river had overflowed and spilled foul-smelling water across the pathway that I occasionally walk along. A news report spoke of devastation across Australia, especially in Lismore, where the floods had impacted harshly. These once-in-a-lifetime floods are becoming more and more frequent. How long until ravaged homes and loss of life become the norm? Studies conducted by the Bureau of Meteorology tell us that 8 out of every 10 floods in Australia are a result of rising sea levels. It is essential that we work to slow climate change. Reaching net zero carbon emissions by 2050 is a long overdue start.
I mean, after reading back your essay, how do you feel?
At that time, I suppose the flooding was a bit of a novelty. I remember there were kids going down to the parks that were flooded just to play around in the water. But then, you know, you were also getting the round-the-clock coverage on the destruction of the homes, especially in Lismore. And at that age, I guess it all just felt quite scary and imminent.
What is your life like right now, and what matters to you now?
Well, since then, I've moved houses, moved schools a couple times. It was 4 years ago, so it's always a bit awkward, I feel, reading back old writing, because you feel that you've matured and changed a little bit since then. But yeah, I still care about the environment and what I see on the news.
Would you hope that the environment also matters to more people beyond younger generations?
Yeah, I think it's a big concern, especially for young people. I think at the time, the flooding in Lismore sort of brought it to the forefront of a lot of people's minds, you know, the effects of the real world effects of climate change. And I hope that people care about it and it matters to people.
Amy Briggs speaking to Maisie, Joseph and Ruby. And of course, there's a big conference on the 14th. That's at the Australian Museum in Sydney, but a national focused one with all the young people putting their ideas together and seeing what it amounts to in terms of a generation coming up.
Sounds fantastic. And also be sure to check out some of the great programs right across the ABC made by First Nations content makers to mark NAIDOC Week, including right here on Radio National. I highly recommend checking out All in the Mind, which explores the mental health benefits of Indigenous language revitalisation.
And next week on The Science Show, the science of slime. A philosopher turned to a physicist is looking at mucus. And we'll also have the future of sleep. I'm Robin Williams.
And I'm Belinda Smith.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.